When I consider Lynn's life, I see many of these same traits, and I think there is a real possibility that Lynn was a direct contributor to Bitcoin. In light of the unprecedented attention that cryptocurrency is receiving, I'm hopeful I can bring attention to one of the unsung heroes to whom we owe credit. I also hope that we can reflect on the immense importance of addressing mental illness, and especially functional neurological disorders that deserve far more attention. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. We have a really epic piece reading on the show today. It gets a little difficult at some parts, and so it's a little bit longer, and there's not a huge guy's take after this. I admit, I had to re-record a handful of kind of choked up sentences in this piece. But it's a pretty brilliant tribute to one of the lesser known cypherpunk giants, and who may very well have been Satoshi himself, Lynn Sassaman. And if he wasn't, then no doubt he was someone who absolutely was critical in laying the foundation that Satoshi was standing on when building Bitcoin and helped make Bitcoin a reality. And this one's Lynn Sassaman and Satoshi, a cypherpunk history. And it's written by Evan H., who I have not been able to source anywhere else. And a couple of articles about this piece refer to them as Leung. Also can't find attributing who that is. So I have no idea who the author is. And I assume that is on purpose. But let's go ahead and get into the read. This is a really, really good one. But first, real fast, let's thank our sponsors. We got Swan Bitcoin, the automatic Bitcoin savings plan. And also, I kind of forget about Swan Private. SwanBitcoin.com/private is for corporations and high net worth individuals. And it's a really good, they provide tax assistance. There's guidance on self-custody. They give instant purchases of up to $10 million. I know I talk a lot about their savings plan, but Swan really is kind of a full-on entry service into the Bitcoin ecosystem to establish your position and hold your own keys. And speaking of holding your own keys, our other amazing sponsor is about securing the ownership, your sovereignty, and your keys with their BitBox hardware wallet. They are a Swiss company. Their top focus is security and ease of use. This is a really good device for people who are newer to the space, in my opinion. And they've got a lot of other great backup accessories like the Steel Wallet and Tamper Evident Bags on the Shift Crypto store. Check them both out at the top of the page at guyswan.com. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled Lynn Sassaman and Satoshi, A Cypherpunk History, by Evan H. We've lost far too many hackers to suicide. What if Satoshi was one of them? Embedded on every single node of the Bitcoin network is an obituary. Hacked into the transaction data, it's a memorial to Lynn Sassaman, a man essentially immortalized in the blockchain itself. A fitting tribute in more ways than one. Begin tribute. Lynn Rabbi Sassaman, 1980 to 2011. Lynn was our friend, a brilliant mind, a kind soul, and a devious schemer. Husband to Meredith, brother to Calvin, son to Jim and Dana Hartshorne, co-author and co-founder and shmoo and so much more. We dedicate this silly hack to Lynn, who would have found it absolutely hilarious. Dan Kaminsky, Travis Goodspeed. P.S. My apologies, Bitcoin people. He also would have lulled at Bitcoin's new dependency upon ASCII Bernanke. Embedded above this tribute is an ASCII text image of Lynn Sassaman's face, and below is ASCII Bernanke. In block number 138,725. Lynn was a true cypherpunk, equal parts brilliant, irreverent, and idealistic. He devoted his life to defending personal freedoms through cryptography, working as a developer on PGP encryption and open source privacy technology, as well as an academic cryptographer researching peer-to-peer networks under blockchain inventor David Chaum. He was also a pillar of the hacker community, a friend and influence to so many of the important figures in the history of InfoSec and cryptocurrency. Losing Satoshi. By all accounts, Lynn was on track to be one of the most important cryptographers of his time. But on July 3, 2011, he tragically took his own life at 31, following a long battle with depression and functional neurological disorders. His death coincided with the disappearance of the world's most famous cypherpunk, Satoshi Nakamoto. Only 2 months before Lynn died, Satoshi sent their final communication. Quote, "I've moved on to other things and probably won't be around in the future." After 169 code commits and 539 posts in the span of a year, Satoshi disappeared without explanation. They left behind a slew of uncompleted features, raging debates about their vision for Bitcoin, and a still untouched fortune of $64 billion in Bitcoin. We've lost too many hackers to suicide. Aaron Schwartz, Gene Kahn, Ilya Zhytomyrsky, James Dolan. All of these victims of stigma and an epidemic that has exacted a price on technological progress itself. Imagine if the creator of Bitcoin died well before they could see it through. And if that were true, what would they have given the world had they been treated with the concern and dignity they deserved? I hesitate to speculate about Satoshi's identity, given that the discourses generally ranged from misguided to downright idiotic and unethical. But with Craig Wright fraudulently claiming credit and invoking a copyright claim to take down the Bitcoin white paper, it's important we revisit the topic and recenter the discussion around the cypherpunks who actually built Bitcoin. Whoever Satoshi was, they were very much standing on the shoulders of giants. Bitcoin was the culmination of decades of accumulated research and discourse within the cypherpunk community. In this sense, Lynn was unequivocally an indirect contributor. Yet one has to wonder, who actually wrote the code, ran the first node, and posted using the Satoshi pseudonym? To synthesize and implement the myriad ideas Bitcoin was based on, that person or group of people would have required a unique combination of expertise spanning public key infrastructure, academic cryptography, peer-to-peer network design, practical security architecture, and privacy technology. They would likely have been deeply ingrained in the cypherpunk community and adjacent to the figures who proved to be major influences on cryptocurrency. Finally, they would have needed the ideological conviction and hacker ethos to roll up their sleeves and anonymously build a real-world version of ideas that had previously been relegated to the realm of theory. When I consider Lynn's life, I see many of these same traits, and I think there is a real possibility that Lynn was a direct contributor to Bitcoin. In light of the unprecedented attention that cryptocurrency is receiving, I'm hopeful I can bring attention to one of the unsung heroes to whom we owe credit. I also hope that we can reflect on the immense importance of addressing mental illness, and especially functional neurological disorders that deserve far more attention. Origins. Even in his youth, Lynn was a self-taught technologist who gravitated towards cryptography and protocol development. Despite living in small-town Pennsylvania, by 18, Lynn was on the Internet Engineering Task Force, responsible for the TCP/IP protocol underlying the Internet, and later, the Bitcoin network. quote, always kind of the odd kid because he was smart. Lin was diagnosed with depression as a teenager. Unfortunately, he suffered traumatic experiences at the hands of borderline sadistic psychiatric practitioners, experiences which would presumably leave one distrustful of purported authority figures. In 1999, Lin moved to the Bay Area and quickly became a regular in the cypherpunk community. He moved in with Bram Cohen, creator of Mojo and BitTorrent, and was a contributor to the legendary cypherpunk mailing list where Satoshi first announced Bitcoin. Other hackers remember him as intelligent and lighthearted, chasing down a squirrel at a cypherpunk meeting and speeding around in a sports car with a, quote, get-out-of-jail-free card in case he was pulled over. In San Francisco, Lin devoted himself to defending personal liberties and privacy through both technological and political direct action. At 21, he made headlines for organizing protests against government surveillance, as well as the imprisonment of hacker Dmitry Skylarov. PGP. Early in his career, Lin distinguished himself as an authority in public key cryptography, the foundation of Bitcoin. By 22, he was presenting at conferences and had founded a public key crypto startup with famous open source activist Bruce Perens. After the startup collapsed in the wake of the dot-com bubble, Lin joined Network Associates to help develop PGP encryption central to Bitcoin. Working on the release of PGP 7 in 2001, Lin set up interop testing for OpenPGP implementations, putting him in touch with many important crypto pioneers. Lin also contributed to the GNU Privacy Guard implementation of OpenPGP and worked with PGP inventor Phil Zimmerman to invent a new cryptographic protocol. When introducing Bitcoin, Satoshi said he hoped Bitcoin could be, quote, the same thing for money that strong cryptography, PGP, was for securing files. Quote, a generation ago, multi-user time-sharing computer systems had a similar problem. Before strong encryption, users had to rely on password protection. Then, strong encryption became available to the masses, and trust was no longer required. It's time we had the same thing for money. Hal Finney. At Network Associates, Lin worked on PGP alongside Hal Finney. Finney was the second PGP developer and helped create the RFC 4880 standard for OpenPGP interoperability. He was also the earliest and most important contributor to Bitcoin after Satoshi. Finney was the first person other than Satoshi to contribute to Bitcoin's code and to run a Bitcoin node. Finney was the first recipient of Bitcoin, sent from Satoshi himself. Finney invented the concept of reusable proofs of work, which Bitcoin's mining is based on. Satoshi corresponded with Finney extensively, even before Bitcoin's release. In one of their last posts, Satoshi publicly intimated their respect for Finney. Unsurprisingly, Finney is one of the most popular candidates for Satoshi, though this implies that Finney faked his extensive email interactions with Satoshi and simultaneously contributed to Bitcoin under both his real name and a separate fake identity. Finney would also continue to work on Bitcoin well after Satoshi had moved on in 2011. Remailers. Lin and Finney shared one very rare and relevant skill set. They both were developers of the remailer technology that was a precursor to Bitcoin. Proposed by David Chaum alongside cryptocurrency, remailers are specialized servers for sending information anonymously or pseudonymously. It was very common to use them when contributing to the cypherpunk mailing list, which itself was built on distributed remailers. As a primary developer, node operator, and principal maintainer for Mixmaster, Lin was an eminent expert in remailer technology. He also implemented similar technology as a systems engineer and security architect for the Anonymizer Privacy Guard. Not only were remailers a direct technological progenitor of Bitcoin, they were fundamental to its intellectual history. In the essay, Why Remailers? Finney argued that remailers were the foundation of an anonymous digital economy. Quote, "Remailers represent the ground floor of this house of ideas, the ability to exchange messages privately without revealing our true identities. In this way, we can engage in transactions, show credentials, and make deals without government or corporate databases tracking our every move. One cypherpunk vision includes the ability to engage in transactions anonymously, using digital cash. This is another area where anonymous mail is important." Remailer operators were some of the first to recognize the need for cryptocurrency. Without a means for anonymous payments, remailers had to be run altruistically at their operators' expense. This introduced scalability issues and meant that spam and abuse were a constant problem. Because of this, many concepts fundamental to cryptocurrency emerged from the need for an abuse-resistant, for-profit remailer. In 1994, Finney proposed that remailers could be monetized via anonymous, quote, coins and cash tokens. Smart contracts were first discussed in the context of preventing remailer abuse. Nick Szabo's prescient 1997 paper on smart contracts specifically references Mixmaster. Ian Goldberg and Ryan Lackey, both of whom Lynn knew, were major figures in the remailer community who worked on an unfinished cryptocurrency called Hindi in 1998. Ian later created several early eCash clients, and Ryan went on to become CSO of Tezos. Accordingly, Satoshi's second post about Bitcoin stated that pay-to-send email was Bitcoin's first working use case. Quote, "Initially, it can be used in proof-of-work applications for services that could almost be free, but not quite. It can already be used for pay-to-send email. The send dialog is resizable, and you can enter as long of a message as you like." Adam Back. Crossing paths with Lynn in the small remailer community was Blockstream CEO Adam Back, the first person to communicate with Satoshi. Back's own interest in cryptocurrency started from running a remailer, and he created the Hashcash proof-of-work system for remailer operators to combat spam and DDoS attacks. Satoshi would later use Hashcash as the basis of Bitcoin's mining. We know that Lynn directly collaborated with Back, listing him as a contributor to a research paper, as well as a Mixmaster memo. Both worked on numerous OpenPGP implementations and were connected in each other's PGP web of trust. Interestingly, Back himself has suggested that Satoshi might have been a remailer developer, noting that the devs would, quote, "practice their own technology" to pseudonymously contribute to cryptographic protocol discussions. Unlike many cypherpunks discussed, we know that Lynn made extensive pseudonymous contributions to the cypherpunk mailing list via remailers. Tweet from Bram Cohen. "It's a bit emotional for me to talk about this, but I will say that Lynn posted pseudonymously on the cypherpunk's mailing list constantly, including at least one fleshed-out and long-lived handle, and even I didn't know what it was. Also, I have a vague memory, mostly because Lynn told me about it and I wasn't paying close attention, that there was a NIM called Product Cipher, which pseudonymously posted the first Ring Signatures implementation to cypherpunks and then disappeared. The implication with that one seemed to be that it was Hal or Lynn or some combination of the two. Very unsure, though, and don't know if it got clarified later." Bram Cohen's response to this article, suggesting he and Hal Finney could have pseudonymously collaborated. Chom and Kosick. After high school, Lynn worked to support his family and never had the chance to attend college. In spite of this, in 2004 he secured his dream job of a researcher and PhD candidate at Kosick, the Computer Security and Industrial Cryptography Research Group of KU Leuven in Belgium. Lynn's PhD advisor at Kosick was none other than the father of digital currency, David Chom. While Chom laid the groundwork for the entire cypherpunk movement and all cryptocurrencies, few could claim to have worked with him directly. a few of Chom's relevant accomplishments. The invention of cryptocurrency in his 1983 paper, Blind Signatures for Untraceable Payments. The invention of the blockchain, with his 1982 dissertation, including code for all but one element of the blockchain, detailed in the Bitcoin White Paper. The creation of the first electronic cash system with his company, DigiCash. Anonymous payment between digital pseudonyms was central to this vision. Quote, Chom stands in the thick of a movement that seems unstoppable, the digitization of money. The wild card in the era of digital money is anonymity, and David Chom thinks we're in trouble without it. While DigiCash failed, partially due to a reliance on centralized systems, Chom wanted to create a second digital currency that would offer a combination of anonymity and practicality. While many saw its failure as proof that digital cash was infeasible, Satoshi defended the, quote, old Chomian currencies while acknowledging the issues caused by centralization. Quote, a lot of people automatically dismiss e-currency as a lost cause because of all the companies that failed since the 1990s. I hope it's obvious it was only the centrally controlled nature of those systems that doomed them. End quote. Lin's research. Okay, let's take a break real quick. I need something to drink. Let's hit the sponsor really fast, and we will jump back in on Lin's research. SwanBitcoin.com is simply the best place to go to get allocated, to get started, and to learn about how to get into the Bitcoin ecosystem, to start your positioning, your savings plan in Bitcoin. They have an automatic savings plan. So if you want to buy regularly, you want to DCA and ignore all the market noise, you can get every month, every week, every day, you can buy Bitcoin on an automatic basis. You set it once and forget it. And that's in addition to an instant buy button of up to $10 million. And with Swan Private at swanbitcoin.com/private, they have resources and assistance for how corporations and high net worth individuals can build generational wealth with Bitcoin. You get direct access to the Swan Private team. You get tax form assistance, guidance on how to self-custody, wire support with no limit on purchases, and even guidance for your retirement account. If you've been thinking about allocating to Bitcoin and you haven't done it yet, don't wait. Start now. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy, and it even gives you $10 free just to start off your plan. That's swanbitcoin.com/guy. Lin's research. Lin worked at Kosik in Belgium until his death in 2011. In that time, he accumulated an impressive 45 publications and 20 conference committee positions. Lin's research was focused on developing privacy-enhancing protocols with real-world applicability and working code. His main project, aided by Bram Cohen, was the Pension Gate, an evolution of remailer technology that allowed for pseudonymous information retrieval via a network of distributed nodes without a trusted third party. This work was very pertinent to Bitcoin. As work on the Pension Gate progressed, Lin became increasingly focused on finding solutions for the Byzantine fault, aka Byzantine Generals problem, that had been a major obstacle for earlier peer-to-peer networks. In the context of distributed computing, Byzantine fault tolerance refers to the ability of a network to remain functional even when nodes are compromised or unreliable. The Byzantine fault was one of the biggest problems that needed to be solved for a secure, decentralized cryptocurrency without double spending or the need for trusted third parties. Satoshi's most important innovation was a triple-entry accounting system that solved this using the blockchain introduced by Chom. During Bitcoin's development in 2008 to 2010, Lin was increasingly active in financial cryptography. He joined the International Financial Cryptography Association and presented at the Financial Cryptography and Data Conferences, where he also held a committee seat. The latter was founded by Robert Hedinga, an early and prominent advocate for digital cash, which was a major topic at the conferences. Satoshi as academic. Numerous clues suggest that Satoshi was working in academia during Bitcoin's development, an idea embraced by Bitcoin Foundation founder Gavin Andreessen. Quote, "I think he's an academic, maybe a postdoc, maybe a professor, who just doesn't want the attention." Satoshi's code contributions and comments ramped up heavily during summer and winter break, but tapered off in late spring and the end of year, when an academic would have been taking and/or grading finals. The idiosyncratic construction of Bitcoin's code also suggests that Satoshi had an academic background. It has been described as brilliant but sloppy, eschewing conventional software development practices like unit testing, but exhibiting cutting-edge security architecture and an expert understanding of academic cryptography and economics. Quote, "Whoever did this had a deep understanding of cryptography. They've read the academic papers, they have a keen intelligence, and they're combining the concepts in a genuinely new way." When prominent security researcher Dan Kaminsky first reviewed Satoshi's code, he tried to pen test it with 9 different exploits, but was amazed to find that Satoshi had already anticipated and patched out all of them. Quote, "I came up with beautiful bugs, but every time I went after the code, there was a line that addressed the problem. I've never seen anything like it." This might suggest that Satoshi and Kaminsky had a shared set of InfoSec experiences and expertise. Coincidentally, Lin and Kaminsky co-authored and presented a paper demonstrating methods for attacking public key infrastructure. Additionally, the Bitcoin white paper was released in a medium rarely seen on the Cypherpunk mailing list, a LaTeX-formatted research paper with academic trappings, such as an abstract, conclusion, and MLA citation. Compare this to other proposals like BitGold and B-Money, which were unstructured blog posts. Satoshi in Europe. Since Kosik was based in Leuven, Lin was living in Belgium during Bitcoin's development. This is salient given that a number of facts suggest that Satoshi was based in Europe, the primary focus of an early inquiry by the New Yorker. Satoshi's writing exhibits spelling and word choices idiosyncratic of British English, such as bloody difficult, flat, maths, grey, with an E rather than an A, as well as the day, month, year, date format. However, Satoshi also refers to euros rather than pounds. Bitcoin's Genesis block also included a headline from the day's copy of The Times newspaper. The Times, January 3, 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. This headline was specific to the print version, which was only circulated in the UK and Europe. In 2009, The Times was a top 10 newspaper in Belgium and, quote, "heavily used by scholars and researchers because of its widespread availability in libraries and its detailed index." These clues leave us with a paradox. They suggest Satoshi was European. Yet, someone with the requisite skill set and exposure to Bitcoin's primary influences would likely have been American. Much of the cypherpunk community coalesced conferences and meetups, part of why a disproportionate number hailed from America and especially San Francisco. The jobs where one could have gained cutting-edge professional InfoSec and crypto experience were similarly concentrated in the U.S. Strangely enough, Lin used the very same British English as Satoshi, even though he was American. A series of tweets from Lin Sassaman. January 20th, 2011. "Wow! Is the 10th anniversary of BitTorrent really coming up in a few months? I remember the release party. 10 hackers in a small SF flat. Having gotten used to the gray in my beard, I'm surprised at how distressing at finding my first gray mustache hair. April 26, 2011. Dear every phone manufacturer in the world, must SIP configuration be so bloody difficult? Do you get kickbacks from the telcos for that? February 25th, 2011. At Hypatia.ca, PZ Myers, sadly, does not understand maths, particularly AIT, which shows up in nature quite often. Analysis of Satoshi's posting history suggests they were a European night owl who worked on Bitcoin after returning from a job or school during the day. At one point, Satoshi also stated that an increase in mining difficulty happened, quote, yesterday, which would not have been true if they lived in the U.S. Quote, assuming Satoshi lived a life outside of Bitcoin, he did so during the working academic day when he was largely away from his computer at home. If Satoshi lived in a BST time zone, he worked mostly at night, often in the small hours. And when we examine Lin's tweet history, we see the timestamps of Satoshi's posts and code commits correspond closely to Lin's own hours of late-night activity. Just to give an idea here, we've got a chart based on the hour of day and the frequency of posts, and the first is Satoshi's post to BitcoinTalk.org forums, and the second is Lin Sassaman's tweet frequency by hour, and they are pretty eerily similar. Peer-to-peer networking. While not the first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin was the first to be based on a fully peer-to-peer distributed network. The importance of this is emphasized in Satoshi's very first reference to Bitcoin. Quote, I've been working on a new electronic cash system that's fully peer-to-peer, with no trusted third party. In order to build Bitcoin, Dan Kaminsky stated that Satoshi would have needed to understand economics, cryptography, and peer-to-peer networking, and Lin had an unusually early and intimate exposure to all three, along with their application to digital currency. While in SF, Lin lived and collaborated with Bram Cohen, creator of the most widely used peer-to-peer protocol, BitTorrent. During this period, 2000 to 2002, Bram developed a revolutionary peer-to-peer network called Mojo Nation, which used a digital currency of, quote, Mojo tokens, making it one of the first digital currencies to see a working public release. Tweet from Bram Cohen. Mojo Nation was a glorious failure. It went down in flames, but directly led to BitTorrent and Bitcoin. There are few failures anywhere near that successful. In Mojo Nation's peer-to-peer economy, quote, tokens could be exchanged for the storage of files, which would be encrypted and encoded into, quote, blocks, uploaded to a distributed network of nodes hosting a public ledger, recalling Bitcoin's own system of distributed bilateral accounting. Mojo was not merely an internal accounting token, but a full currency. It could be exchanged for dollars and vice versa. Some of the first discussions of tokenomics concern the mechanics of Mojo tokens. Quote, a unit of Mojo represents a slice of the current capabilities of the system as a whole. If you perform work for me now, I give you credits. In the future, when the network is larger, those credits will represent a slice of a much larger pie, and so have increased in value when you spend them. Satoshi discusses tokenomics in a very similar way. Quote, it is the potential for a positive feedback loop. As users increase, the value goes up, which could attract more users to take advantage of the increasing value. While visionary, Mojo Nation's economy quickly collapsed due to hyperinflation. Satoshi consciously designed Bitcoin to avoid this fate via built-in deflation and non-reliance on a central mint server. Tweet from Bram Cohen. I can confirm that hyperinflation did in fact happen in it, although I haven't thought about it much and hadn't realized that that had been studied and the learnings incorporated into later projects, most notably, of course, Bitcoin. In 2001, Bram launched BitTorrent. As a peer-to-peer alternative to the centralized Napster, BitTorrent foreshadowed Bitcoin's own distributed node-based topology and system of consensus, as well as its protocol-level incentive system. BitTorrent innovated on networks like Nutella, not only at a technical level, but also by using economic incentives and game theory. presciently, Lynn told Bram that, quote, BitTorrent would make him bigger than Napster founder Sean Fanning. Satoshi would later reference Napster when explaining the need for a fully decentralized network. Quote, governments are good at cutting off the heads of a centrally controlled network like Napster, but pure peer-to-peer networks like Nutella and Tor seem to be holding their own. Coincidentally, Lynn and Tor founder Roger Dingledine both worked on the Mixminion Remailer protocol, co-presented at Black Hat, and founded the Hot Pets Conference together. In 2002, Lynn and Bram co-founded a conference called CodeCon, which was focused on, quote, highly practical projects with working code. At CodeCon 2005, Finney introduced reusable proofs of work via a modified BitTorrent client that sent peer-to-peer digital currency. One commentator described this as, quote, the world's first transparent server, which could facilitate a world of distributed cooperating RPOW servers. Digital currency was a prominent subject at the first CodeCon, which included a demonstration involving Adam Back's Hashcash, as well as Zuko presenting Mnet, a fully open-source and decentralized successor to Mojo Nation. Mojo wasn't tied to a single company and could be independently audited, both of which Satoshi considered crucial. Mojo Nation co-founders Zuko Wilcox and Jim McCoy also proved to be inspirations for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency pioneers in their own right. When releasing Bitcoin version 0.1 on Bitcoin.org, Satoshi included a link to Zuko's blog. Zuko would later go on to found major privacy-focused cryptocurrency Zcash. He created the oft-discussed Zuko's Triangle framework. Zuko's Triangle is a trilemma of three properties that are generally considered desirable for names of participants in a network protocol: human meaningful, decentralized, and secure, at the three corners of the triangle. McCoy also is a major influence within cryptocurrency, and Ryan Selkis of Digital Currency Group has stated his belief that McCoy could be Satoshi. Hacktivism. Even by the standards of the cypherpunk community, both Lynn and Satoshi had especially strong ideological convictions and commitments to open knowledge. Quote, I wish you wouldn't keep talking about me. Maybe instead make it about the open source project and give more credit to your dev contributors. Satoshi's hacktivist approach of distributing Bitcoin via a free, open source grassroots project contrasts starkly with their predecessors. Chaum, Stefan Brand, eCash, and others took a very different approach, filing patents, founding closed-source venture-backed companies, and attempting to drive adoption via corporate partnerships. This paralleled Lynn's own extensive contribution to open-source projects like PGP, Mixmaster, GNU Privacy Guard, and others, as well as his extensive volunteer experience with groups like Shmoo Group. Tweet from Bram Cohen. Lynn also tried to get me to publish BitTorrent pseudonymously, which seems indicative of something. In response to this story, Bram stated that Lynn had a predilection for anonymous releases. Satoshi alluded to their ideological leanings on a few occasions, saying that Bitcoin was, quote, very attractive to the libertarian viewpoint, and that it could, quote, win a major battle in the arms race and gain a new territory of freedom for several years. Lynn was similarly passionate about the need to defend open knowledge and technological advancement from corporate and governmental interference. Quote, the quest for knowledge is a fundamental part of being human. Any kind of prior restraint against that is, in my opinion, a violation of our freedom of thought and conscience. So not only am I hopeful that we can avoid overly restrictive knee-jerk legislation, I don't want to see anyone build a framework that could be misapplied for that purpose. Endings. Just as Satoshi created Bitcoin from behind a pseudonym, Lynn was, in a sense, forced to live behind a persona of his own. Following an incident in 2006, Lynn suffered from increasingly severe non-epileptic seizures and functional neurological problems, which served to exacerbate the depression he had battled since youth. As a victim of stigma, Lynn, quote, felt like he had to keep up this facade of being the same hyper-competent guy, and was, quote, absolutely terrified that his declining health would bring an end to his work and disappoint the people he cared about. Despite these challenges, Lynn continued to work until months before his death, contributing to papers and even presenting at Dartmouth. Sadly, he was successful in concealing the severity of his situation from almost everyone in his life. Quote, there were very, very few people who had any idea just how far things had gone. The one refrain I heard over and over was, we never knew. It seemed like he was doing fine. Just as Lynn built on ideas that came before him, one gets the sense that he was devoted to building things that would outlast him. One reason he was committed to open source and open knowledge. This is our heritage, this research, these ideas that we have, that is leading to knowledge that no human in history has had the opportunity to have before. This is what we're going to be handing down to future generations. We need to make sure we are not backed into a corner where we are not able to distribute this research to others, and that this isn't locked up in IP lawyer vaults. When Lynn passed away in 2011, it represented a huge loss for the cypherpunk and the tech community at large, a fact reflected in the huge outpouring of memories and sympathy that followed. One comment in particular still stands out to me. A Hacker News post from, quote, Pablos08. I became friends with Lynn, and we were co-conspirator cypherpunks at a time when that was a wild frontier. We were reimagining our world, riddled with crypto systems that would mathematically enforce the freedoms that we treasured. Anonymous remailers to preserve speech without fear of retribution. Onion routers to ensure nobody could censor the internet. Digital cash to enable a radically free economy. We have schemes to decentralize and distribute everything. We imagine complex and esoteric threats to problems we might someday have. We architect futuristic protocols to insulate against those threats. All this is a highly academic geek utopia exercise. I tend to keep it that way. But Lynn wanted to get his hands dirty. Cypherpunks write code. And this was from Evan H. I gotta say, I didn't know a lot. Like, I knew the name in passing, just in all the many videos and things, but I honestly couldn't have told you much of anything about Lynn Sassaman before this piece. This is a pretty epic breakdown of his legacy and the fact that he absolutely could have been Satoshi. And, you know, just kind of in the grand context, I hope we never figure out who Satoshi is. But at the same time, the search for who Satoshi might be can shed so much light on somebody like this that has been so pivotal to finding our way to Bitcoin, to all the other cypherpunks that led us here. And it's kind of cool that, you know, we get to relook at Lynn Sassaman here and see everything that he did in a new context and actually explore something that might have gone unappreciated or not thoroughly explored. And it goes to show as well that even if Lynn isn't Satoshi or wasn't Satoshi, how easily it could have been so many people. How many people were so intricate and near to this idea for so long, and somebody finally put those pieces together. Somebody who wanted to get their hands dirty and wanted to sit down and write the code, make it a reality. This was an excellent piece. I don't even know how to find Evan H. on social media. I don't, like, this is the only post under this name on Medium. It is a black box for a logo, and in the about page, all it has is a SegWit address. like a Bitcoin address to, you know, donate to. So if you want to donate for this piece, I will have the link in the show notes so that you can go check that out. The Bitcoin address is at the bottom of the read, as well as in the about of Evan H, the user, whoever that is. It's also really awesome. I had no idea that there was an obituary in a transaction in a block. It was 138.725 for Lynn Sassaman on the Bitcoin blockchain. And there is straight up like a little ASCII text in the transaction data of, you know, what looks like Lynn's face. And thinking about the context of building something that will last beyond us. And you know, that's the goal here, right? Is that Bitcoin is not something that we're rushing to get everybody to adopt tomorrow. This is not a startup or a business. This is something that we want to solve the problem of money. We want to build something that lasts generations, that lasts centuries even. And that's the point of this. And to have Lynn immortalized forever in that project, whether he be its quote unquote father or just his obituary in block 138,725. It's pretty epic to have a tribute to him there for everybody to go see. But before we close this episode out, I want to have a segment. It's only about 9 minutes long, but it's from Lynn's wife, Meredith L. Patterson. But it was linked to, and there were a couple of quotes that were specifically from this conversation. And a little bit of warning, it's pretty heavy. It's Hope Number 9 is from 2012, and it's a presentation conference thing about geeks and depression. And even though it's like I said, it's pretty heavy, you know, I think it's always good. It's never a bad time to take a moment and get a little perspective on the why all of this. Like why all of this is being done, and to not lose sight of what's real in the context of just chasing all the fun number go up and meme and everything like that. You know, there are real things and real people and real lives behind all of this. And ultimately, that's the goal. That's the mission of Bitcoin, is to help protect all of that. So I'll be dropping that audio in just a second. Before we do, just a quick thank you to our two awesome sponsors, Swan Bitcoin for the automated savings plan. You got to set it up. You get $10 free at swanbitcoin.com/guy when you set up your savings plan. And then, of course, the BitBox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. It's a really awesome security device and wallet. And highly recommended. Using the code GUY, you get 5% off. So with that, we'll close this out with this segment from Meredith Patterson and kind of her story about her and Lynn and like when all this happened and her take on depression and like this whole video. It's about an hour and a half. I'll have it linked in the show notes as well. Depression really is a surprisingly major problem in kind of the geek community, the geek and hacker community. You know, even the author mentioned how many of the prominent hackers and cypherpunks or builders in the space that we've lost to suicide. So I hope if you actually want to go look at this, maybe it will be of some help to somebody out there. Like I know a couple of people who I would say are, you know, have pretty significant problems with depression. And I know I would hate to lose them over not having done something. And to think that we lost Lynn without needing to. And whether he was Satoshi or not, just what he could have built and what an incredible benefit to everyone he was already, and so much potential there was left. I don't know. Just a hard reality to accept. It's a high cost. So I'm going to go. I've got a couple of presentations and stuff from Len Sassaman lined up, and I'm probably going to be watching a bunch of videos of him for the next couple hours. So with that, I'll leave you with Meredith Patterson, his wife, telling a short version of his struggle as best you can. Thanks for listening, guys, and I'll catch you on the next one.
So I'm not really going to be telling my story, but rather Len's story, which is in large part a story about the stigma that's attached to chronic depression, and you know, to an extent, mental illness in general, but you know, especially depression. So you know, Len grew up in Pennsylvania, a small town with a boys' prep school in it. Went to Catholic school as a kid, but he was always kind of the odd kid, you know, because he was smart, had some health problems, which, you know, later turned out to be Crohn's disease, but, you know, when he was eight, he was just the weird kid who can't eat pizza on Fridays. He was diagnosed with depression when he was a teenager. And in his late teens, went through some pretty traumatic experiences that left him with a profound distrust of the of psychiatric care in general. Pretty much entirely the fault of some sufficiently incompetent as to be evil professionals. And you know, when you're 17 and you don't even have power of attorney over yourself, you don't have the ability to fire your doctor. But anyway, so after a rough separation of his parents, he ended up leaving town, moving to the Bay Area, and pretty rapidly getting catapulted into a certain amount of fame as an anonymity and privacy activist. And he was still struggling with both the health problems, you know, the physical health problems and the depression. But with the help of SSRIs, you know, things were staying fairly stable. So in about 2004, even without without a college degree, you know, he never spent a day in college, because when his parents separated, he had to take care of his mom and his little brother. But just from working as hard as he possibly could, I mean, this is kind of the dark side of the American up by your bootstraps myth. You know, people get to feeling like if they, you know, if they bring themselves up from a difficult or underprivileged background, and yeah, you know, and something goes wrong, that, you know, that it was their fault, that they weren't up to snuff or something, you know, and that can be just particularly toxic to somebody who's living with depression. So 2004, he got accepted to the PhD program in electrical engineering at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, and went over there to work on anonymity and privacy research full time. You know, dream job, totally. We met in 2005 and started dating. And then in 2006, during a Crohn's flare-up, he went on prednisone, as is usually the case when your immune system decides it wants to hurt you, and suddenly started having seizures. And that was basically the point where everything started tumbling downhill. Although it did later turn out that the prednisone was implicated somehow in the onset of the seizures, they did continue. And over the course of the next several years, he started experiencing more and more neurological problems that we were just never able to track down that we were just never able to track down the cause of. Those of you who met Len, at any point in the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years, probably remember he walked with a cane. That was because his back was slowly degenerating on him, and he was terrified, just absolutely terrified, of losing his mobility, of not being able to finish his PhD, of disappointing everybody that he respected and who cared about him, and despite the fact that we always told him, look. We love you. We know you're brilliant. You don't have to prove anything to us. He still felt like he had to prove it to himself. And so, last summer, I had to go to Houston abruptly because of now it seems kind of silly, but my elderly cat, who we left with my parents when I moved to Belgium. Yeah, the cat died. I flew home to see my family for a little bit. Turned out I was going to have to stick around for a bit longer for work. So I arranged for a friend of mine a friend of both of ours, really, to fly out to Belgium and just, take care of him. To take care of any of the stuff that he needed help with around the house because of the mobility problems he was having. And so... Yeah, Ted gets to Belgium on the morning of July 3rd, goes to the apartment. No answer at the doorbell. So he went to the church up the street, borrowed a ladder, climbed in the window, and found Len hanging from a wardrobe. So. And I think the hardest part about that, really, was that there were very, very few people who had any idea just how far things had gone. I mean, even I really didn't know. But, the one refrain that I just heard over and over again in the days following was, we never knew. He always seemed like he was doing fine. But that's the point. When he would come to conferences, that was... Yeah, we had friends, of course, who would come over and hang out in Belgium, but he didn't really he wasn't physically able to get out a lot, and he loved going to conferences and seeing people, but that was also a lot of stress on him because he just felt like he had to keep up this facade of being the same hyper competent guy that everybody had gotten to know when he moved to the Bay Area back in '99. And I think the reason for that is, like I said, there's this stigma that's attached to depression. People think, well, what do you have to be sad about? Your life is fine. And it's not about being sad. I've experienced episodic depression. I've had other friends of mine kill themselves too. But that's not the same as having, your brain chemistry constantly sabotaging you on a daily basis. And that is nobody's fucking fault. That is nobody's fault. That is just bad fucking luck. And so, if there's one thing I want to accomplish out of this, it's to get rid of that, it's to get rid of that fucking stigma, because that's what kills people. So, yeah.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.